Hello there, wherever you are, and welcome to a new edition of Big Mouth, the pop culture talk show for the connoisseur train spotter, where we give a good going over to the world of music, film, TV, books, and all related matters. My name is Andrew Harrison, and this week we'll be looking at the entertainment world's latest attempt to deal with the advent of President Trump, the new albums from Masters of the Male Midlife Crisis Elbow and Ninja Tune Beat Baron Bonobo, and we'll be talking about Netflix's new adaptation of A Series of Unfortunate Events, starring Neil Patrick Harris. We have, for a change, just the one special guest this week, but he is exceedingly special. He's among The Guardian's chief music critics and the author of 33 and a Third Revolutions Per Minute, A History of Political Pop. He's a graduate of Mixmag and Select in the 90s, who now writes for Q and Empire magazines. Like all right-thinking people, he's mad about the Pet Shop Boys and comic books. It's Dorian Lidsky. Hello, Dorian. Welcome back to Big Mouth.
Hi, Andrew.
How are you doing?
I'm angry all the time.
I know, that is the consistent modern condition now, isn't it? We're going to have to get used to it for the next 4 years or so, aren't we? Yeah. You've just done the cover story for Q with the XX then.
Mm.
How are they? I mean, were you able to bring out the Q-ness in these rather reserved individuals?
They've come along a lot.
Yes.
I read their older interviews in preparation and was slightly terrified because there was a lot of padding because they didn't say a lot.
Yes.
But they've come along. You know, it's been a few years since the last album. Mm. They've sort of grown up, and they're very likable.
Yeah.
Very likable bunch. And their story, I think, is genuinely really interesting.
Yeah.
Sort of like falling into being very well known and then sort of having to learn to deal with it.
It is a weird state of affairs, isn't it, when a band like the XX are like Q front row, because it's not mega rock, is it? It's not Coldplay, it's not U2, it's not kind of like, here's the grand spectacle, it's like, here's three very shy people being shy of your entertainment.
Well, I was writing something recently about Portishead's debut album, and the similarities were quite big there, you know, where they're toiling away, you know, in anonymity, creating this very sort of private, intimate record that somehow becomes, you know, ubiquitous, like a TV soundtrack and a dinner party soundtrack, and then they kind of have to deal with that.
I wonder if that's kind of like a sea change in big music, in that, you know, actual gigantic stadium rock now looks like something from the past, doesn't it? You know, the Foo Fighters seems terribly noughties. You'll still see the big celebrations, but even people like Coldplay have to kind of pretend to be a sort of semi-alternative indie band rather than just getting out there and punching the air, you know?
It's hard to be a big band these days. It's really sort of difficult to find that space.
We mentioned comic books a minute ago. You've just done a fake feature for the Wicked and the Divine comic, didn't you? Which is one of the best comics on the stands at the moment. It sort of involves a world where there are no pop stars, but there are gods. And they did this special edition, which is like a fanzine or a magazine about these god stars. And you had to come up with a fake interview, didn't you?
Yeah, so we had to do this interview via internet chat. And it was, I thought this was going to be very artificial. And weirdly, just within minutes, it felt like I was basically interviewing, because the character Baal, I felt like I was interviewing a rapper. And there was this sort of slight sort of tension in some of the exchanges. And I had this whole sense of who he was and where he was. And the character that Kieran had created was so consistent. It was actually, you know, really pleasurable. And the fans seemed to like it. And that was just one of those things that when I was a young teenage comic book buff, someone had said, you will actually get to write a bit of a comic book, I would have been cock-a-hoop.
Can you pull back the curtain and say who was actually on the other end of the internet connection?
Oh, yeah, it was the writer, Kieran Gillen. That's how he sort of did it with everyone. But everyone did their own approaches, and because some people were very kind of literary and you know, used their imagination a lot. Because I'm a journalist and I have no imagination. I just thought, I'm going to treat this, as play this as straight as possible and be like, it's an interview with Jay-Z. Mm. Or something, and just sort of try and make it as believable as possible.
Yeah, God. It's amazing that they would actually do a spoof magazine just as actual magazines are fading out of existence. Yeah, it's kind of a heritage presence.
Although, like a real interview, the access with Baal was very limited.
Very, very limited. Yes. And, you know,
Given any stuff that you couldn't talk about?
It was very, it was short, and it was quite tense, and it was just in a kind of bland room. So, yeah, no, it was very much like my real job.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about that. That's personal. Also with us, as usual, ensuring that our tops aren't too toppy and our bottom end not too bottomy, it is our producer, the John Leckie of Podcast. Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm fine. Just throwing the paint around, even as we speak.
Throwing the paint around. Yes. How's your week been?
It's been kind of okay.
Yeah. Do you think we should stop doing a pop music podcast and just do politics the whole time?
Because football,
that's
maybe.
Football. Let's not talk about football right now. That's. Don't bring me down. Okay. Let's get started. As I mentioned, there's too much politics around. It's been a bizarre and unprecedented week.
Get it?
In every avenue of human endeavour, with the first week of the Trump presidency ringing, an exciting surprise every day. It might seem like a minor consideration to ask how music and movies and that world are reacting, but Hollywood is to America what royalty and the class system are to Britain. So we might as well suck it up. Before we get into the developments, let's that set the tone. From a pre-election project last year where a song was recorded every day in a run-up to the US presidential election, this is Moby and the Homeland Choir. This song is called Trump Is On Your Side. Trump Is On Your Side by Moby and the Homeland Choir. What do we make of that? Is that a bit on the nose? You know, sort of a pop song going, President Trump is a bad person, rather than an elusive thing.
Well, they did so many. Yeah. I mean, they did, it was maybe 30 and 30 days, and it ended up with 50 and 30 days. And yeah. It was sort of, if you're interested in protest songs, as yeah. I am.
Uh-huh. That must have been cabinet for that whole thing.
It really, well, but basically it was like, you could almost do like a kind of, you know, a study module on it, because there were different kinds. There were yeah. some that are very satirical. There were some which were sort of, you know, almost character studies of Trump.
Yeah.
There was some that were, you know, straight up sloganeering. It was all these sort of different angles on it, you know, and there are probably very few sort of great ones came out of that. Yeah. But as an experiment in just getting people to work out how you write about him,
it was great. Yeah, because we've had like 20 years of sort of political pop being very indirect and not kind of naming the perpetrators. It's been sort of, you know, ambiently political rather than, you know, Radiohead are always sort of, oh, they're enormously political, and they never actually do a song called Tony Blair Was a Bad Person. They just like do things about melting ice and sort of very kind of oblique references to these things.
Thinking aloud here, and it may be about to be shot down, but what has the last 20 years of kind of political issues been the quite kind of big general things that actually artists find it quite easy to latch onto? But that's slightly unfortunate, for, you know, unfair phrase, but global warming, deforestation, poverty, you know, international poverty, whereas now actually you can see the bad guys.
Well, you need a villain. I mean, there's a reason why there were lots of songs about Nixon and Thatcher and Reagan. Yeah. Reagan, who now seems rather lovable by comparison. But, you know, there's definitely something about having a character, you know, a kind of symbol of the things that you're opposing. Very difficult if you've got a sort of centre-left government that is sort of doing some things you like but is disappointing you in other areas. Yeah. It's very hard to sort of create that kind of Aunt Sally and just thump them.
Yeah, although, you know, there wasn't exactly an avalanche of David Cameron, You're an Evil Man songs, whether it's just, you know, big wet blanket there, not really standing for an awful lot.
Whereas Trump is a genuinely kind of monstrous creation, you know, that there's that he sort of resembles so many fictional nightmare presidents.
Yeah.
That, well, it gets ridiculous.
You said that he makes Reagan look kind of avuncular. He actually makes President Lex Luthor, seem like a reasonable guy with a program and an ethos and a set of ideas.
Well, most supervillains, they're actually quite charming. They think, well, I don't want people to see that I'm evil.
Yeah.
Where Trump doesn't have that self-control or charm. So.
Yeah. But then, of course, every villain is the hero in their own story. Dr. Doom is the hero. You know, he's like, I'm set the world to rights, you know, and I'm sure Trump is the hero in his own world. Amongst the developments this week, Brian Eno told The Guardian that he's pleased about a Trump presidency because it's going to give us a kick up the arse. Just imagine if Hillary Clinton had won and we'd been in business as usual. The whole structure she'd inherited, the whole Clinton family myth. Now with Trump, there's a chance of a proper crash and a chance to really rethink. I mean, this is the worst kind of insulated, well-off pop star stupidity, isn't it? This is somebody who's never really going to be touched by it. Viewing it as a distant experiment.
Well, this hurts me because I love Eno to bits.
Yeah.
But this is very much the old kind of, you know, communist idea of heightening the contradictions.
Yeah.
Which never really works because, you know, some people thought this in the 60s. It's like the worse it gets,
the better it gets.
Hasten the revolution. And in fact, what they got instead was Nixon.
Yeah.
You know, it does not work, making things awful and hoping. I mean, things are awful in Greece.
Yeah.
And that hasn't had some kind of miraculous rebirth.
No, they've just got a bunch of Nazis.
It's really hard. You know, the left-wing government there has had, you know, many, many challenges. And the point is that while you're waiting for the revolution to come, there are people who are losing their rights. Yeah. There are people who are losing health care. And I just found an astonishingly strange thing to say.
This is like Amanda Palmer saying that we're going to get some great punk rock out of Donald Trump. I can do without the great punk rock, actually. I really, I don't even like great punk rock. I don't want any more of it on the back.
Also,
of
you know, there might be some great punk rock. There's going to be a lot of really, really bad punk really rock bad as punk.
Well, to be fair, most punk rock. Anyway, let's not get into that. Also, much less annoyingly, perhaps, Courtney Love has rewritten her biography on Twitter by using alternative facts. I went to Yale and majored in Japanese history, and I love trap music. I've never done drugs in my life, nor have I ever sworn in public, nor smoked a cigarette. It's highly amusing, but it does make you think, you know, is this all we've got? Are we going to have to, we're gonna have 4 years of taking the piss and not much else to cling to?
Well, I think you can do a lot of different things at once. And I think at the moment, it's this relentless sort of rolling trauma. Mm. It's like this sort of H.P. Lovecraft advent calendar where each day you open it and there's just all,
Yeah, I know. And today, the president had relaunched his White House press conferences in zoo format. Yeah. Tomorrow, let's ban all abortions.
And you sort of can't take it all in. And so I think, okay, you need rage, you need satire, you need marches, you need, you know, ground level organizing. You need lobbying Congress people and you know, trying to fight back on a kind of on a local level. You know, American friends of mine. You know, they're taking this very, very seriously. You know, you phone your local representative, you donate to Planned Parenthood. All of these things can happen.
Yeah.
And I think you've got some musicians who are steeped in this stuff. You know, like Tom Morello, who's doing Prophets of Rage now with, you know, Chuck D and Be Real, everyone. You know, he's kind of like, you know, he's partly community organizer. He's a very clued up, he's like Billy Bragg. He like knows the nuts and bolts.
Yeah.
And other people, you know, they're going to they're going to contribute a song. They're going to appear at, they're going to be Miley Cyrus appearing at a rally. They're going to be making a funny joke on Twitter. You know, it's all sort of helps this sort of mood of resistance.
Well, you and I had a bit of a to-do on Facebook about this, didn't we? But on the Saturday Night Live sketch, the Trump sketch about the water sports business, my feeling about it was, yeah, this is a great laugh, but actually what you're doing is you're handing over the keys to your opposition, because the water sports thing is not proven. It's looking highly unlikely. It's like Cameron and the pig. Highly unlikely that it's going to be proven. And it's handing over the keys to the people on Trump's side to say, look, it's all lies. Look at the lies. They're all lies. Everything's fake news.
The thing is that they're operating on such a high pitch of kind of deceit and norm breaking that these things that I think, you know, liberals rightly think are perhaps a little beneath them, you know, like joking about this thing that may not be true, like doing memes of a Nazi being punched. And they think, oh, but this gives the other side an excuse. And it's like, they don't need an excuse.
Yeah.
They are going to do this stuff anyway. Yeah. They are going to lie anyway. They're going to present, they're going to be bullies who present themselves as victims anyway. Mm. And I feel that sometimes, you know, liberals give ourselves too much power and assume, well, if we obey the highest standards and don't give them an in and a charge of hypocrisy, that will work. And it's like Obama maintained the highest standards for 8 years.
Yeah.
The Republicans acted appallingly, constantly sabotaging him. So I don't think we should deny ourselves these kind of smaller, irreverent pleasures as if they're actually going to make any difference, because he's so far out there. Yeah. We're not kind of ribbing Mitt Romney, and it's like, oh, but that might make Mitt Romney a little bit petulant.
Yes.
It's like, it's Trump. There really is nothing that we can do which is going to give him more of an excuse.
Yeah.
He's literally fabricating voting fraud. He's in calling for an investigation into something that hasn't happened.
Yes.
You know, it's sort of, so I think we should get our last where we can.
I am coming around to this because, you know, from, you know, they go low, we go high, which patently hadn't worked and didn't work. I am coming around to, you know, more Mr. Nice Liberal and just, you know, get down to that level.
Someone's going to have to rewrite that, the analogy about wrestling a pig, that you both get dirty and only the pig enjoys it. That actually, you both get dirty, but, you know, you get some pleasure out of it.
You both need to enjoy
can.
It, yeah. Okay, right, that's enough politics. Thank heavens we never have to talk about Donald Trump ever again on this show. Let's have some tunes. Every week we ask our guests to come in with a track that they're loving and the editor's recommendation. Dorian Lenski, what have you got for us?
I have the new single from Father John Misty, title track of his album Pure Comedy, which I'm afraid is also sort of political.
Okay.
But in the...
Sorry, viewers.
But in the sort of grand scale, so it's sort of human nature, and the whole album is based on this kind of, like, his rather kind of cynical view of human nature. And I think the whole album is kind of remarkable, that what he's doing here is really quite different from the last album lyrically.
Father John Misty, bit of a dick.
I am a big fan. I interviewed him. I thought he was fantastic. Mm. I think he's maybe he's kind of divisive. He sort of rubs people up the wrong way, but I never quite sure what he's meant to have done wrong. People that really hate him, they can never particularly point to this thing that he did. Like you can with Morrissey or Lou Reed or whatever.
Yeah.
They just don't like him. And I like him, like, massively.
Yeah, I thought a lot of people think he's quite supercilious. He did a pretty catastrophic Six Music interview where it was a lot of sort of snorting and sniggering, and he didn't really come out of it very well. But then, do we...
Well...
Yeah, I know, but yeah, first time for everything.
That's become a kind of benchmark of, you know...
Yeah, anyway, let's have a listen. This is Father John Misty with Pure Comedy.
The comedy of man starts like this. Our brains are way too big for our motherships. And they get terribly upset when you question their sacred texts, written by a woman hating epileptics.
That was Father John Misty with Pure Comedy, the Harry Nilsson of modern ironic relationship music there. Okay, so in these cheerful times, what better to do than to retreat into a modern gothic fantasy where innocent children lose their parents in a fire and are persecuted by an evil count who will stop at nothing to gain their inheritance. The Lemony Snicket books, A Series of Unfortunate Events by Daniel Handler, have already been adapted into a fairly unsatisfactory Jim Carrey movie. Now Netflix are having a go with a new 10-part series starring Neil Patrick Harris as the villainous Count Olaf. We can't play the theme tune because it's not out yet, but in 2006, Stephen Merritt of the Magnetic Fields recorded an album with his band The Gothic Archies, inspired by the Lemony Snicket books, from the Tragic Treasury. Here's The Gothic Archies with Scream and Run Away.
The Count has an eye on his ankle and lives in a horrible place. He wants all your money, he's never at all funny. Run, 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 run. Or die, 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 die.
The Gothic Archies with Scream and Run Away, which isn't on the TV soundtrack to A Series of Unfortunate Events, but might as well be. The series popped up on Netflix in mid-January. Matt and Doreen, you've got kids. Are these books genuinely interesting to kids? Do they love them?
Yeah, my daughter has read them. My son's a little bit kind of too young. He's 9 at the moment, but they love them. They don't mind the death and general kind of like air of despair that surrounds them, which I'm kind of quite intrigued by.
How are they big in your house?
They are, and I really loved... I mean, I started off reading them to my eldest daughter, and now she... Yeah, and then she was old enough to read them herself. Because I'd actually discovered them a few years earlier, before we had kids, because my wife had bought me this spin-off thing called The Unauthorized Autobiography of Lemony Snicket.
Right.
And it's full of all these weird little... the only way I can say it is it's almost like Thomas Pynchon for kids, and it's all these weird documents and conspiracies and codes and kind of faded photos circled going, why has this person only got like, you know, three fingers or whatever? And I just thought, what the hell is this? It generally thought it was like sort of Crying of Lot 49.
Yes.
The kids. And then when, you know, when we had kids and I could actually get into this world, just, it was such a great thing to bond over because I never felt Harry Potter sort of in my gut. I thought it was fine. So this was our thing. This was the thing that we were both into.
Yeah. What do you make of the TV adaptation?
Well, I've only seen one episode so far. Eleanor's just binged all 8 of them.
Yeah.
Without me. I said, we should watch it together. And she's like, no, I'm just going to watch them all now.
Oh, thanks.
I've only seen one. The weird thing about it is that, I mean, it's very faithful to the book. But apart from the addition of the narrator, which I think is a very good thing.
Yeah.
Actually making Lemony Snicket a character.
Well, let's see what the young people actually think. We've got Dorian's daughter and Matt's kids to give their opinion. Here are B, Stan, and we're starting off with Eleanor.
My name's Eleanor, and I'm 10 years old.
I'm Stanley, and I'm 9.
I'm B, and I'm 12 years old. I think the Lemony Snicket TV series is a really good series, and I think it's quite alike to the books.
I really liked how they adapted the books to do a TV series. It's like, I didn't think that it would work, and then I watched it and I was like, whoa, this is really good.
I really like the programme. I like the fact that each episode carries on from the last. Like, it includes bits from the last episode in the next one, so it's kind of running.
I really liked the action in it. I just loved the fact, because I love action on telly, and also the mystery.
I think that the Baudelaire children are like I imagined, but I think they look a bit different. Count Olaf is what I imagined, because it described him really well in the books, and it kind of looks exactly the same.
The cast, it looked very similar to the movie, and because I really liked the cast in the movie, I liked the cast here. But I also liked the fact that you got to see Mrs. Poe, Edgar Poe and Alan Poe. It just showed, like, how miserable the Baudelaire orphans' lives were, just in, like, the first hour of their parents dying.
The bit that I like best is the bit where Count Olaf dresses up and he's in his woman's outfit and he shaves off his beard and he's got big curly locks on and he's got loads of, like, layers upon layers of lipstick on.
In the Aunt Josephine episode, when they were coding the message and like, Violet was getting really frantic, like, come on, Klaus, the house is falling to bits, hurry up. And Klaus was trying to decode the message, trying to figure out what it meant.
I don't have a favourite funny part, but I think one of the best is the episode with Montgomery, because it's obvious that, like, the man, his assistant, Stefano, is Count Olaf, but Mr. Poe just, like, he's so stupid, he doesn't get it, and he thinks, like, oh no, it's all gonna be good. So stupid.
I am looking forward to, in the next season, seeing book 6 being made into TV series, because that was always one of my favourite books, and I would love to see that on TV.
Julia Bigmouth there with a concentration on cross-dressing and human misery. This is clearly what the young people want. What is it with this kind of fascination with decaying fairgrounds and rotten castles in American culture? Because they don't have that middle European thing. This thing is totally Kurt Vile, it's Threepenny Opera, it's, you know...
But they do have that tradition of the carny as being a kind of slightly weird place where rules don't apply and where you don't know whether people are nice or bad.
It's quite... that East Coast thing. There's bits of sort of Boston that sort of remind me of this. And there's a little, musically, obviously, Stephen Merritt, you know, Dresden Dolls.
Yeah.
There is that kind of strand. And what I really loved about the books when I started reading them to my daughter was that they really credit kids with a lot of intelligence.
Yeah.
And that whole thing of, like, you know, vocabulary, introducing them to words, but also kind of crediting them with maybe knowing them already. Mm-hmm. The darkness constantly going, you don't want to read this, read something happy instead. And of course, kids are instantly just like, oh, I think I can handle this.
Well, but they do that really nicely in the series, don't they? Where the kids are always kind of, a word is used by an adult.
Yeah.
And they turn to the kids and say, do you know what that means? And then the narrator comes in and goes.
And there is this way of this sort of, like, you know, the world of, you know, which obviously Eden Blyton was into, whatever, you know, secret societies and codes and stuff, but with this much more kind of, you know, adult sort of paranoid sensibility. Yeah. So it's always kind of, it's one of those kids' books that's got so much sort of adult content that, you know, not only obviously can a parent enjoy reading them, but it kind of brings the kids up a notch. Yeah. It kind of flatters them.
And they've transferred that to the series really well. I mean, the production values on it are just fantastic, and the amount of kind of special effects and CGI and stuff in it. But they've done that really classic kind of kids fiction TV stuff where all the adults, I think it was mentioned in the clips there, all the adults are really stupid and venal, and the only intelligent and sparky and nice people in the whole, well, occasionally the one of the kind of uncles or people that the kids get put with are quite decent, but they get killed really quickly if that's the case.
And there's, like, Joan Cusack's fantastic as Judge Strauss, who's a very, you know, loving character, but she's obviously completely deluded. And get, you know, the great conceit is that the only sensible people in the world are kids. The only, you know, the only smart people, the only curious people in the world are kids, and everybody else is this sort of self-serving cartoon. I can really see the appeal of that.
You know, the one criticism you can make of the show so far, maybe, is that it's so faithful to the books. Mm. You know, that I actually feel like I kind of know this already. But yeah. Thank God they haven't like lost the voice, because that's the thing. That's the point.
Well, the interesting thing is going to be, is it going to be the kind of kids equivalent of Game of Thrones? And are they going to keep on going back to it? And then are they going to run out of books?
No, apparently it's three seasons.
That's it.
Three short seasons, all 13 books. There's going to be no additional
there's
ones.
There's going to be an ending.
Yeah. There's going to be an ending. Because it gets berserk. The last sort of three books,
yeah.
It genuinely gets so strange and sort of complicated. Not quite Lost. I don't want to put people off by saying it's like Lost, but it gets a lot weirder than you would imagine from the beginning.
Excellent. But I mean, as somebody who's never read the books, you know, you don't have kids, you don't read these books. I was completely, you know, bowled over by the just the visual oddness of it, but also the kind of, you know, the joy in the bleakness and the joy in the misery was really, really refreshing. Because, you know, when you see Disney Kids TV out the corner of your eye, it's kind of stomach-churningly positive, full of tartrazine, full of bright colours.
Mm.
And I think somebody's got to breed the future goths of tomorrow. Somebody's got to breed the future depressive sitting around the War Memorial drinking cider of tomorrow. Where are they going to get their mental
nourishment
from?
This is totally goth training wheels.
It is totally goth training wheel, and I thoroughly approve. Well, okay, let's get back to music. Poor old Matt Hall never gets a chance to recommend a track, but he does this week. Matt Hall, what's your editor's recommendation for the week?
It's something which shows the power of Spotify and their algorithms. And it's a thing that came up on my last week's Discover playlist. And it's two artists, Katie Goodman and Greta Morgan, who are from different bands in kind of the LA dream pop scene. And they've done a cover, an album covering a load of punk tracks. And they've covered tracks by American artists like Danzig and the Misfits that mean absolutely nothing to me, but they've also covered The Jams in the City, Dreaming by Blondie, Billy Idol, his Rebel Yell track, but this one, which is a version of the Buzzcocks' Ever Fall in Love With It. It's a bit proust because I think it's the first ever Buzzcocks single I bought, so I can remember going and getting this on 7-inch, but it's just a lovely, very, very different take on it.
So now it's been remade for your mature years, Matt.
It has.
Here we go then. This is Ever Fallen in Love by Katie Goodman and Greta Morgan. Was Ever Fallen in Love by Katie Goodman and Greta Morgan. All right, well, we promised earlier that we're going to talk about a couple of the big albums this week. Bonobo, a.k.a. musician-producer Simon Green, has been part of Cold Cut's Ninja Tune stable of artists for about 15 years. For most of this time, he's been largely an underground breaks and beats type person, but his sixth album, Migration, entered the UK charts at number 5 last week, making him pretty much the label's most successful artist yet. Before we talk about that, Elbow released their seventh album, Little Fictions, this week. It's a red letter day for Lacrimose, middle-aged blokes, and all men who want to tell you that they really love you, mate. Is it any good? We're going to find out after listening to this opening track from Little Fictions. This is the first single, Magnificent, she says. And Magnificent, she says. Dorian, to me, often feels like Elbow are trying to get out from underneath one day like this, where they had their great big euphoric moment, and now that's their job to provide the great big euphoric moment all the time.
But they're not on this album. Mm-hmm. I mean, they weren't really. I mean, there were a couple of kind of big tunes on the last album, but they were definitely not trying to be that. I can't quite imagine them maybe going back to the sort of O2 again. Because, you know, they really had this moment where they'd been around for a few years, a few albums. Seldom Seen Kid was just massive, gave them this whole new audience. You know, they're reliably sort of great at Glastonbury. And it's sort of ever since, they have kind of, they've really insisted on, I suppose, where they came from, which is these kind of, you know, their Talk is like Guy Garvey's favourite band. And this kind of subtle, emotionally, you know, vulnerable, quite witty, you know, very, very witty lyrics, I think, a lot of the time, very well-observed lyrics. But there's a kind of subtlety, and which is great, I think, because one of the worst things that can happen to a band is that they get that big breakthrough record, and then they just have to keep trying to do anthems. Mm. I mean, it kind of ruined, like, I mean, I was never a huge Kings of Leon fan, but once they had their big, you know, Sex on Fire, You Somebody, I mean, they've just been, like, essentially worthless since then, because they're always trying to be, like, big, and arena-ish.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I always get the I get the feeling from Elbow that it's like, well, you know, that's not really what we're about. And it's nice that we had those songs. We're not going to try and do them again.
But he had a Guy Garvey had a bit of a sort of, I mean, he broke up with his long-term partner, didn't he, before the last album. And that really seemed to sort of put a...
Put the mockers on.
Well, put him in a different lyrical direction. Because I sort of, listening to this new one, it, you know, he's thinking lines like, I will fly straight and true like an arrow just to be where you lie. And you kind of wonder, who's he singing it to? Is there a new person in his life?
Oh, yeah, yeah, he's married.
So he's married again,
yes,
has he?
Okay, this is right. Like the kind of the love album after album.
It's quite a funky record. The first few tracks are actually quite kind of upbeat and quite, you know, with quite a kind of... You know, funky, and they've, you know, they're obviously really good musicians, but the looseness of the drumming and the kind of rhythms and stuff is really quite different, I think.
I think because their drummer left, which is odd because they were such good mates, they had the same lineup for like 20 years. I think the drummer left, and so they were doing a lot of this stuff with program drums.
Yeah,
I think there's kind of a bit of an irony in the fact that a guy who can write so astutely and brilliantly about and descriptively. Chooses to describe kind of people, or more specifically men, who are actually really bad at expressing their feelings. I think it's kind of a weird...
But that's the conceit of Elbow, isn't it?
Yeah.
Here is the band that with a man who can express emotions very well, expressing them like somebody who can't. Like, it's guarded emotions expressed beautifully, which I think is what people connect with, what men connect with.
Yeah.
Obviously, as someone who hates all emotion and feeling, I don't really get an awful lot out of it. But, you know, I can see that that's why people do like it.
But it was like the way that sort of, where people said almost accidentally, I think Oasis did this, because Noel Gallagher's not a big feelings guy, was, you know... but you
know, the front page.
Yeah. Sort of like, you know... crying, you know, at chucking out time at the pub, you know, Don't Look Back in Anger, Wonderwall, those kind of things. Whereas Guy Garvey is a very kind of, he's quite sort of emotionally sophisticated guy. He's very sort of insightful and empathetic. And I think that's something that he is deliberately going for, not in a manipulative way, but that there is a kind of, there's an emotional matter of factness, but then in quite a poetic forms of expression.
Yeah.
But some of the kind of, I almost think he's underrated as a lyricist. I think that there's...
He's a fantastically well-read bloke, isn't he?
Yeah,
he's
astonishingly...
Loves words. Yeah.
There's a bit where he's, on his solo album where he's describing the twilight, someone sitting in a cafe in the twilight, and he just says, proper hopper. Which is so sort of northern. It's a slightly silly rhyme, but it's a really great allusion.
And you could... And on this one, I think on the track Montparnasse, when he talks about kind of like, for the sleepless insane, and there's obviously... When you've written down, it's obviously insane, as in the river Seine in Paris. But he's just doing it for like, and what was it? A pair of boozy bower birds. He, kind of, you know, he just loves playing with the sound of words and how they kind of run together, which is great.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, one of the lyrics I pulled out, which I thought was really a great little couplet, we're all the hero when directing the scene. The therapy for liars is a giant ice cream. I'm not entirely sure what he means by that, but I like it.
And squeezing out my words like I'm icing a bomb, I particularly liked as
well. Icing a bomb with an alien.
I don't know.
But even if you think of like, you know, their biggest banger, you know, One Day Like This, when he's talking about being older and he goes, when my face is chamois creased.
Yeah.
And it's just like, that's got to be the most successful song ever to feature the word chamois.
Yeah.
I don't know, was there a... I'm cleaning windows, did that not involve chamois?
Window cleaning does involve a chamois, but I don't know if lyrically...
I thought you were about to describe Guy Garvey as a contemporary George Formby there. And I think you might be onto something, because, you know, there's a certain northern spirit that's being invoked there. Yeah, so this Bonobo album then, which is, you know... It does share something with the Elbow one, which is this is, you know, he's worked with a live band that recreates and plays loops, and we've just heard Elbow trying to effectively play loops, you know, want to play in a loop grooving thing. The Bonobo album's quite a departure because, you know, he'd previously been, you know, Mr. Bangers and Mr. Live Performance. And this is like a bunch of glitch experiments. It's called Migration. It's about migration. Dorian, what do you reckon?
I do not enjoy the music of Bonobo, but I do very much love, you know, Ninja Tune and the people, you know, the people there.
They're good people.
And I think that a lot of the time, you know, you need these kind of breakout commercial acts. And I think it's amazing that Bonobo has become, I say commercial, I mean, he's become very successful.
Without being commercial,
It's not as if it's straining for hits here. It's just that I suppose I don't never really know what he's bringing. There's bits here where you go, well, that's a bit like Burial. That's a bit like Fortet. That's a bit like all down tempo music since about 1993. Yeah. Like, I'm never really quite sure what his sort of flavour is. And I think with down tempo producers, you know, whether that be Burial or, you know, back in the day, you know, Kudo and Dorfmeister or DJ Shadow, you could literally hear four bars. And you go, that's them. That's their sound. And there'd be a certain kind of mystery or kind of resonance to it. And he just always seems like he's just thrown everything into this kind of, into the blender. And it's come out and it's a, you know, it's quite a tasty smoothie.
First of all, I have kind of slight problem. You kind of get the feeling that he came up with the name, his artist name, stoned in a flat one time back in the mid-90s, and then all of a sudden he's realised that he's a really successful artist and he's still named after a bloody monkey, you know, which is slightly embarrassing, isn't it? It's like Rag and Bone Man. It's like,
don't start with
at
him.
Some point, 5 years down the line, he's going to have to change his
name.
He's going
to do a Mikey Old and go, this is me.
Yeah, precisely.
Whatever his real name is.
But also, I think that, you know, I think that with a lot of these artists that came out of that kind of True Thoughts, Ninja Tune scene of the kind of mid-90s, late 90s, there's always seemed to be a slight lack of quality control around those labels. And that's not a criticism, because some of it's fantastic, but a lot of it gets put out without kind of like there being a label kind of A&R type person going, maybe this should be tightened up, maybe this one, maybe you need to go back and do this again.
But Ninja Tune in particular was just absolutely... You know,
deluge.
Yeah, you just couldn't keep up with it. And it'd be like a triple compilation every 6 weeks with all the millions of things they'd put
out. But I was sort of immersed in this stuff in the 90s and probably had all those triple compilations. And what I missed, which I think is an interesting phenomenon, is the way that people like Bonobo and Fat Freddy's Drop, you know, not on Ninja Tune, but these sort of people that have ended up, and then you see a poster and they're headlining Alexandra Palace.
Yeah,
yeah,
and the way that
cinematic orchestra,
who I do like,
yeah.
But yeah, the way that these kind of these people that you slightly sort of took for granted, you think, oh yeah, it's good sort of, you know, down tempo stuff, became these kind of really big international live acts, and because of that kind of music, it translates really well to Europe and
South America, because they're always bringing in a little bit of salsa and a little bit of kind of, you know, South American music in general, aren't they? As the spice. So bonobo monkeys are apparently the most sexually promiscuous apes or monkeys of all. They will have sex with anybody, regardless of age, gender, or family relationship, just as a general greeting. So just while you're thinking about that, here's a track from Migration. This track's called Kerala. Okay, that was Kerala by Bonobo from the album Migration, and the clock is running down. It's time for Closing Time Chatter, where we share the stories and ideas that are exciting us or driving us mad this week. Dorian Linsky, what have you got?
Well, I've been writing something about the fourth of the Netflix Marvel shows, Iron Fist, and I thought, I haven't read anything. I haven't been a regular comic book reader since sort of, you know, since my teens.
Yeah.
And I thought I should probably check something out. And there's this series from about 10 years ago called The Immortal Iron Fist.
Yeah.
By Ed Brubaker and Matt Fraction and an artist David Aja.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And it's brilliant. In this character that I never really cared about.
Yeah.
It's just, it's sort of, you know, witty and fantastical. And it, you know, because I do get quite, there's a lot of times I'll check out a comic book and I just think, do you know what? I'm too old for this. Like, this just seems silly.
Yeah.
And this just seemed like a kind of rip-roaring yarn and beautifully illustrated.
Well, by strange coincidence, I've also been reading that same run of Immortal Iron Fist.
Oh, have you?
Because it was cheap on Comixology and I really like Ed Brubaker. I thought, I'll give it a go. So I hoovered them all up and they are fantastic. But what I really loved about it was he spent an inordinate amount of time on making up names for kung fu moves.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Fist of Nine Poisons. Breath of the Dragon and all these things. It's like page after page of it. It's really funny.
Well, there's the episode titles of the new Iron Fist series have leaked, and they're all after kung fu moves.
Yeah.
And I had to Google them to see which ones are real, which ones aren't. So Lead Horse Back to Stable,
yes,
is a real kung fu move. And then there were made up ones like The Mistress of All Agonies.
I think I used to go out with her actually.
And there's just such a kind of like this sort of joyous kind of richness in the language. And the Immortal Iron Fist run has all of that. And yeah. I'm sure it'll bear very little resemblance to the TV series because that would be very expensive.
Yeah, so Immortal Iron Fist. Yeah, catch up on it before it starts on Netflix. Matt Hall, what's your closing time chatter?
Silver linings to really bad things. George Orwell's 1984 is now, or has been this week, number one on Amazon's book sales charts in the States.
Why would that be?
I can't work out. I think it could be that, great, people are kind of like wanting to read one of the kind of most influential dystopian novels. I'm slightly worried that people could be using it as a handbook, that it could be being bought as a kind of like battle plan for the next 4 years. But it's also happening in the UK as well. I actually had a look on Amazon in the UK, and in the top 10 of their kind of classic literature are the book, the audiobook, and the Kindle.
Coincidentally, I've been reading a biography of Orwell and rereading his essays, and there's stuff in there where you could literally just change a few words. There's one where he's talking about how H.G. Wells didn't understand nationalism and fascism, and you can change that a little bit, and it's basically, this is why liberals didn't... this is why they underrated Trump.
Yeah.
There's another one where he's talking about sort of how people disregard facts that don't match their feelings. Mm. And again, plug in echo chamber, confirmation bias and all that lot. You've got that. And I think that's kind of the amazing thing about Orwell. It wasn't so much that he was prescient. He was just the best at actually noticing what was going on in the 1940s and something about the fundamental irrationality of human nature, which many of his kind of liberal intellectual contemporaries, and like me, in fact, you know, underrated the power of these kind of like atavistic urges.
Yeah.
And he's just really good at going, no, this is how bad people can be.
It's a really cheery show, this one, isn't it? I'm going to finish it with a big broad smile, because mine is just a very simple thing. The title of the next Star Wars film will be The Last Jedi, which I find incredibly exciting, but also, who honestly believes it's going to be The Last Jedi? So that's our show. Thanks to Dorian Linsky, our guest. Please visit 33revolutionsperminutewordpress.com. which is terribly interesting and full of music and politics and related matters. Remember, you can hear this show again and all of our archive shows at audioboom.com/channel/bigmouth. And you can subscribe at iTunes. Just go to the podcast section of the iTunes Music Store, search for Big Mouth, subscribe, and you will get the podcast version of the show on Saturday, not Sunday. Matt and I will be back on SohoRadioLondon.com at 9 a.m. next Sunday with some more people. But in the meantime, we're going to finish with my editor's recommendation. I totally slept on this when it came out. This is Hi-Fi Sean, once known as Sean from the Soup Dragons, from his all-star collaboration album FT, as in featuring... perhaps, I don't know. It features Yoko Ono, Norman Blake, and even the late Alan Vega. But this one is his current single. This is Hi-Fi Sean with Crystal Waters. This tune is called Testify. We'll see you next week, true believers. Tell me what you mean.